This week on Life and Faith.
Many of us like technology. We enjoy using it, and enhancing capacity is something we're all interested in. We want more powerful computers and so on. But on the other hand, it's infringing on and impinging on the concept of human identity, what we human beings are.
We have entered into an amusing ourselves to death moment in history.
It doesn't make sense to me. If there is God, God's supposed to be free.
I was 100% sure that I was sacrificing on the altar of truth my only chance for happiness in this world.
Miracles don't necessarily change anybody's mind. It just gets their attention.
And so I had to run with my child on my back, the ISA army coming behind us.
I said, gee, Uncle George, this is luxurious for a communist. Son, he said, nothing's too good for the worker, nothing.
Welcome to Life and Faith from CPX. I'm Simon Smart. Are you excited by or horrified at the thought of a self-driving car? Are you one of those people who look forward to the day when you can order a robot to clean your bathroom? Sounds pretty good to me. Or more seriously, subject yourself to an operation done by a machine driven by AI or artificial intelligence. There's some amazing, brilliant stuff happening in this area. But are there potential risks of AI that sit alongside the possible benefits?
AI and machine learning, they're just tools, ones that make us stronger, smarter, faster.
AI will play an increasingly dominant role across all the many dimensions of what it means to be human.
There's a good chance AI will continue to enhance us in ways both known and unknown, eventually becoming as invisible as the air we breathe.
That narrative will play out across all types of human conditions that will enhance human capability, fundamentally change who we are as a human race.
The question then becomes, if it does, what do we do with our newfound superpowers?
That's from a YouTube original, Using AI to Build a Better Human. And it all sounds very positive. But is it all good news when it comes to AI? We're going to be thinking about some of these questions today with the help of Professor John Lennox. John Lennox is Emeritus Professor of Mathematics at Oxford University. He's an author and well-known speaker, focusing on the interface of science, philosophy, and religion. He famously debated Richard Dawkins twice, the late Christopher Hitchens twice, and also philosopher Peter Singer. And he loves talking about whether God exists, the interaction between science and faith, and what difference these questions make for life. His latest book is 2084, Artificial Intelligence and the Future of Humanity. It's a book that considers the way the increased incorporation of AI into our lives will affect our privacy, the security of our jobs, our political and personal freedoms, and the future of our species as a whole. Where do we come from? Where are we going? Asks Lennox. And his focus here is on technological enhancement, bioengineering, and artificial intelligence. The argument is that the worldview and therefore ethics with which we approach this area will have serious implications for the future of AI and how it interacts with humanity. John Lennox is an old friend of CPX, and I spoke with him from his home near Oxford. Now, firstly, John, for the uninitiated, what is AI? I mean, we know it's artificial intelligence, but what is it? Why is it important? It's not just science fiction, right?
No, it's not just science fiction at all. I think the best way to explain it is to distinguish between two kinds of AI. Roughly speaking, the AI that's currently in operation and doing all kinds of things, and then the much more speculative quasi-science fiction AI. So let's look at the first one, and it's best explained by means of an example. Let's think of medicine. We take 1 million x-rays of people's lungs, and we get the world's best doctors to label them with the diseases that they represent. And then you or I have problems with our lungs, our x-ray is taken, And an AI system now works on this. It has a huge database, that is the collection of 1 million x-rays. It has a powerful computer and a program, an algorithm in that computer that compares our x-ray with the million x-rays. And very rapidly, it puts out a diagnosis, which will be, on average and increasingly so, better than you'll get from your local hospital. So that is an example of a very positive use of AI, and it's being used in medicine, for example, to develop vaccines for COVID-19 and 1,001 different applications. Now, the point of the word artificial is that an AI system, this is narrow AI I'm describing, and it's narrow, why? Because it does only one thing that would normally require human intelligence to do. Now, the system itself is not intelligent. It's not even conscious. It's not even alive. But it simulates intelligence in the sense that its output is something that normally is done by a human being. And there's a lovely paper by one of the pioneers in artificial intelligence, and it's got the title, "The word artificial in the phrase artificial intelligence is real." And we got to remember that, because a lot of the language associated with it is highly anthropomorphic and leads people to think that the intelligence involved is real. It is not.
Yes, and you go to get some lengths in the book to show that to be the case. Now, what about AGI? Is it worth telling us what that stands for as well?
Oh, of course it is, because that's what interests people in their millions, and that's where the science fiction, the Matrix, all that kind of thing come in. Now, AGI, artificial general intelligence, is represented by two directions of research. The first is starting with human intelligence and enhancing it by genetic engineering and all this kind of thing in the quest to produce a super intelligent human. The second drive is research to create something that's called artificial life. That is, that's not dependent on organic material, but rather based on something like silicon, where you're building up some kind of a black box, a system that is more intelligent than human beings, and therefore creating a super intelligence that way. And there's a great deal of hype about this, and various people like Ray Kurzweil tell us, well, it'll happen in about 40 years. And what I notice is it's always about 40 years. Now, there's no doubt that narrow AI is expanding very rapidly. The technology is improving, but there are insuperable, it seems to me, difficulties potentially that lie in the way of artificial general intelligence.
Yeah, and this is, you have some both, I think you're a little bit cynical about what might be possible in that area, but also you have some real concerns about it too, and we'll get to those in a moment. But let's stick with the positive for a minute, because I do think a lot of the book you commit to some of your concerns. But what are the good bits of this? What elements of this endeavor are you really grateful for?
Well, certainly I'm grateful for many things in narrow AI. We should stick with that for a moment, because it is both good and it raises questions. I think any form of AI is like a knife. A really good knife can be used for surgery and it can be used for murder. So I gave you the example of medicine. Then most of us voluntarily wear a personal tracker in the shape of a smartphone. And we're voluntarily allowing it to order various things, like the book I received a couple of days ago. And I know in a few days' time, it will come up with prompts. People that bought this book are interested in that book. Now, all that's marvelous and convenient, but it has a serious downside that is increasingly being revealed, because these mechanisms are harvesting vast amounts of material irrelevant to the buying of books, and that information, which is personal, is being sold without our permission to third parties. And that has led to serious thinking about what is now called surveillance capitalism. In other words, invading our privacy, using our personal intellectual property to sell off to other people. So there begins to be a downside, and hence we need to be seriously thinking about ethical problems.
On balance, are you you seem more worried than you are excited about this?
Well, I think I tend to share that with many other people. It's interesting that the late Stephen Hawking and folks like that actually went to the extent of signing some kind of document, 8,000 of them, being concerned about the uncontrolled development of these technologies, however far they go. Because the point is, and many people don't realize it, they've gone far enough to already being creating alarm. We not only have the positive thing, if you regard it as such, of a self-driving vehicle, I think I still enjoy driving myself, but automatic weapons systems, for example, which raise deep ethical questions. And therefore, we seriously need people to think through the ethics. And that's not an easy matter in a world with tensions that, far from decreasing, appear to be increasing.
Yeah, they absolutely do. And I know you have concerns about when and where this technology gets into the wrong hands. And so there are very real questions about that. Let's turn to some of the sort of things underlying these, even the drive towards this technology. And you quote, in your book, you quote Giles Fraser, who says that for many people, technology and science function in a way that magic used to, in that it produces a fantasy that there can be this quick fix for the challenges of being human. I found that really interesting. I also reflected on this, thinking that, well, it's not hard to see why we're drawn to the quick fix, is it?
Not hard at all. And many of us like technology. We enjoy using it, and we are sucked in to the quick fix idea. But these things begin to impinge on human, not only in human capacity, and enhancing capacity is something we're all interested in. We want more powerful computers and so on. But on the other hand, it's infringing on and impinging on the concept of human identity, what we human beings are. And I feel that's where a lot of the thinking ought to be done, because this is really the first generation, or the first couple of generations, that have the technological power to influence the very nature and make up of future generations of, well, I could say human beings, but would they be human?
Mm. It's a really important question in your book. Of what is it to be human? And you're kind of saying that to remake humanity is, in a sense, to play God, and that doesn't end well, you say. Why not? What's the problem with that?
Well, it's been tried before, of course, in a much cruder way, with the eugenic experiments in Nazi Germany and Russia, and the whole drive to make a Superman was very much in vogue then, and it intrigues me to see that raising its head even higher, with people like Harari and so on saying, yes, that's what we're after, is the transhumanist project. We're going to make a Superman. And I think my basic concern stems a long time ago from reading C.S. Lewis. Two seminal books, The Abolition of Man, which he wrote in 1940, and then That Hideous Strength. And his central idea is, if in the end scientists are permitted to, say, alter the germline and produce modified beings, He says that they won't be human beings, they'll be artifacts. So that, and I quote partly, that the final triumph of science would be the abolition of man, the abolition of human beings and all they mean. And therefore, there is, I think, a real danger in playing God, because the lack of ethical control means there's a fairly large sentiment for if it can be done, it should be done. And the consequences could be frightening. All previous, admittedly crude experimentations with genetics and eugenics have been catastrophic. And attempts to create a superintelligence have usually ended up in millions, if not hundreds of millions, people perishing.
This is Life and Faith from CPX, and I'm speaking with Professor John Lennox about his book 2084, Artificial Intelligence and the Future of Humanity. In a sense, Lennox is calling for a deeper philosophical, perhaps theological, reflection on this topic. Two key questions emerge from the discussion for John Lennox. Who is God and who are we in relation to God? And he very deliberately and unapologetically turns to the material in Genesis, the first book of the Bible, to start that discussion. Now, I guess it requires a bit of openness, at least, to the material from Genesis, but let's assume that for a moment. I asked John, why is the question of the existence of God a relevant one in a discussion of AI?
Well, I think one of the ways in which I was prompted to write this book was observing Harari's atheism, that worldview was driving his agenda.
Right, for people who don't know who that is, you bounce off this in the book quite a lot, but who is that and what's the book?
Oh, Yuval Noah Harari is an Israeli historian who's written two books that have sold in multi-millions, both of Latin names, Sapiens, which is the history of human life as he sees it, and Homo Deus, the man who is God, which deals with the transhumanist agenda that we've mentioned a little bit earlier. And I interact with him because of his huge influence. You notice he's not a scientist, he's a historian. But what he's saying seems to resonate with people. And it's interesting that from time to time in the book, he makes it very clear that his agenda is an atheist agenda. He's turning humans into gods because there isn't a God. The other book that was brought to my attention was a Dan Brown novel called Origin. And in it, his hero, who's a billionaire artificial intelligence expert, he is trying to prove that there is no God using artificial intelligence. Now, that prompted me to say, look, millions of people are going to be reading this. And what is very clear is that we need to ask not only about the technology, but the worldview agenda that lies behind the technology, the big story.
In 2084, Lennox bounces off both Harari's book and Dan Brown's novel, Origin. Here's Dan Brown speaking with the BBC about the novel. And you get a sense of what John Lennox is talking about here, but also a hint that Brown is leaving open some possibilities of transcendence and something beyond the material.
You're talking about technology and religion here, aren't
sure.
you? And the kind of, you know, the discussions between one and the other, aren't you?
Well, you know, it's funny. I mean, the book essentially asks whether or not God will survive science. And it seems like sort of a blasphemous question. But historically, God does not survive science. You know, that we used to have a whole pantheon of gods to describe the natural world. You know, we used to look at the growing tides and say that's Poseidon. But eventually science came along and said, actually, it's not. It's the moon and gravity. And so the question really is, are we naive to think that our gods of today will survive growing science? Will they be here in 500 years or 100 years?
I was listening to a discussion on this on the radio a few months ago. And there was a scientist who's a sort of AIDS expert and based at, I think it was Liverpool University. He re-quoted the Einstein quote of many years ago, saying, the more I study science, the more I believe in God. It's a debate that will continue to rage.
Of course, it's this cyclic thing. I grew up very, very religious. My mother was a church organist. I turned pages for her as a child in church, became very religious, eventually moved away from religion, went into the world of science. And the deeper you get into science, you're absolutely right. It starts to come back. You know, you've got physicists who are looking at the subatomic realm having religious experiences and saying, oh, maybe there is something going on here that's bigger than science.
Right.
That's novelist Dan Brown. Here's John Lennox again.
Now, my view is that every one of us has a worldview. None of us is exempt from having a framework in which we think that would be simply impossible. And therefore, if we're listening to and being bombarded with thinking about the future development in terms of atheist assumptions, it's perfectly reasonable to do as you suggested a moment or two ago and consider other scenarios that have been proposed, particularly the Genesis scenario. For after all, more than half the world's population buys into it, at least to a certain degree. If we're going to listen to the atheist view, then I think it's only fair that we put on the table the biblical worldview and ask ourselves which of these two makes sense of what is actually happening at the moment. So God is in that sense relevant, just as much as the absence of God is relevant as a pair of glasses through which to look and see what makes most sense.
And you're very good in this at teasing out the implications of those different worldviews, because they stand in great contrast. One of the things that you bring to this is a sense of how hopeful the Christian worldview is when it comes to the question of who we are as human beings. Do you want to just give us a nutshell picture of that and then how it relates to the AI?
Yeah. Absolutely, and it relates to the AI in a rather interesting way, because the transhumanist agenda has, as Harari puts it very clearly, for the 21st century, consists in two things. One, the abolition of physical death by technical means, in the sense that although humans will die, they won't have to die. His second agenda is to artificially enhance human beings and enhance their experience of happiness by bioengineering and all the rest of that particular agenda, and humans becoming gods, that is his title, Homo Deus. Now, the Christian, the biblical view, it strikes me that many of these themes are actually biblical if you look at them. They've been, I nearly said, stolen from the Bible. But since, as Jordan Peterson and others have been at pains to point out to us, and Tom Holland particularly, the historian recently, the Bible permeates Western culture at a much deeper level than we realize. And if you think, first of all, the agenda to abolish physical death. Well, that has been a quest since the beginning of Genesis. And the irony, and it is a real irony, is that Harari says we'll do it in the future by technological means. But he's failed to realize that the central message of the Bible is that the problem of physical death was solved 20 centuries ago in the resurrection of Jesus Christ and in his promise to all who trusted him that they would one day be raised from the dead. And if I might use the AI language, be uploaded into heaven ultimately to exist eternally. And I say, look, if we're going to listen to the AI predictions, let's listen to that, because the benefit of the Christian story is that it has strong evidence to support it, both historically and experientially. But then, of course, the second agenda, bringing enhanced happiness. Well, Christ promised to those that trust him that they would have peace with God, and peace is one of the most basic ingredients of happiness. Forgiveness for the mess they've made of their lives and the lives of others. and a permanent hope that transcends death, COVID-19, and everything else. And I say, look, there's strong evidence for the truth of the Christian answer to these things. The evidence for the truth of eventually upgrading humanity and solving death is very thin. And finally, you're trying to do it. Search for utopia, as many individuals and civilizations have done in the past, bypassing the fundamental question of human sin, the rift between humans and God, and the flaws in human nature. And you cannot build paradise that way. But I think the supreme irony, finally, is this. Harari's solution is for humans to become gods. God's solution is for God to become human. And that's the central claim of Christianity. The Word became human and dwelt among us. And so you have this ironical contrast. And when I noticed that, I thought, I want to write something into this space, so at least people will have something to stimulate them to think about another scenario that they might find even more plausible than Harari's.
It strikes me, again, perhaps ironically, that the AI vision is sort of a disembodied vision. And I would argue that Christianity at its best, at least, it hasn't always been expressed this way, but at its best has this sort of groundedness, sort of earthiness, the physicality to it. And the incarnation, that what you mentioned, God becoming a person, there's resurrection, bodies, all this sort of stuff, bodies, seems ironically, in my mind, more positive vision than the disembodied one.
Oh, absolutely. Because it deals with humanity as is. And it deals with the flaws we discover in ourselves. And it offers, to my mind, the only really serious solution to them. As I said earlier, you cannot bypass this kind of thing to get to utopia. And therefore, because Christ offers to not only bring a belief system, a worldview into effect, but actually to transform people and give them a new quality of life and give them new powers to combat the negatives in their experience, then it's far more realistic. And as you say, it's down to earth. It transforms people, families, relationships, and everything else. And also, it's for everybody. The AI vision is for a very small elite by the looks of it.
Now, you dedicate this book to your many grandchildren. Is it, to some extent, a letter to them?
Well, to a certain extent, because I realise that I'm in my mid-70s now, and my grandchildren, the oldest of them, will be going to university probably next year, and they are facing a very different world from the one I faced when I was a young person and a student. And it seemed to me to be important to fill the intellectual space, at least, with a credible alternative to all this naturalism and atheism that is being poured into people's minds by the media that is very biased, especially in this country, and they're not hearing any alternative. And I simply wanted, in some modest way, to redress the balance.
Well, I think you've done that very well, John, and many of us are benefiting from it, so thank you so much.
Not at all. Thank you very much. It's been a delight to speak with you, Simon.
This has been Life and Faith with me, Simon Smart. John Lennox's book, 2084, Artificial Intelligence and the Future of Humanity, is available now. If you've enjoyed this episode of Life and Faith, please leave us a rating or review and send it out to someone you know who might appreciate it. We love to get the word out as far and as wide as we can. Next week.
I think that the human person has a malleability, a creative fluidity to it, which means we are not simply set on the same set of train tracks that are permanent and immovable and take us to a pre-programmed future. The person is responsive to love. And I think, therefore, the person can be redeemed through responding to the love of God. And that means the person's future can be redeemed and can progress.